You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 20th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Cheryl Laird, assistant professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin. On steadfast Dems, how social forces shape black political behavior. Also on the program today, Congress near another aid deal, settling on one. Dems blowing it. Meanwhile, with small business aid drained, Shake Shack returns $10 million. And Ruth Chris runs the grift. Meanwhile, our testing regime, the one for coronavirus, is in disarray. Some may not even work. Meanwhile, the federal government is literally blockading medical equipment from reaching the states, at least before profit can be skimmed off it. AstroTurfed and militia groups lead protests against the stay-at-home orders across the states, many of them just coincidentally swing states. Price of oil plunges. Countdown for Trump's bailout. That'll come quick. In Nova Scotia, a shooting kills 16 people. Meanwhile, in Australia, they will force Google and Facebook to pay for their news content. And thousands of socially distanced Israelis protest Netanyahu. Trump's EPA rollbacks will kill the most marginalized in our society. Meanwhile, Trump seeks revenge on the Indian tribes. And lastly, those donors to Trump's campaign are subsidizing his kids' girlfriends and wives. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, a welcome. It is a pleasure to have you. I am incapable, I guess, at this moment of assessing what year it is. I don't know about you, but I am exhausted. It is, this is a little bit tiring. There's such a weird divergence of the way that people are spending their, or experiencing the stay-at-home order. I've gotten many, many emails from listeners and members of the program who are having a tremendous amount of anxiety because they have lost their jobs. The unemployment procedure in their state is a disaster. And or they haven't been able to get they applied on day one for the Paycheck Protection Act loan, has not come through. People are, you know, it's like a yoga retreat. And, I feel like I'm somewhere in between, not so much yoga-y, but obviously I'm here. This is my job. And so, very fortunate for that. My kids are, a nightmare. Hopefully they're not listening. Now, Amile is not a nightmare and neither is Saul, but I have another family. They're starting to listen now to the show occasionally. So I just want to make that clear. And I've been a bit of a nightmare too, to be fair to the kids. So, it's been a little bit difficult. Schooling at home is difficult. Not seeing your friends, difficult. And everybody's adjusting to the new normal. And, one of the ways that we're doing it here is by having absolutely no sleep. So, thus I open up the show by thinking it was 2018. So apologies for that.
The 420 celebrants in the crowd appreciated that slip up. So,
oh yeah. Jeez. I didn't even realize. So Matt, are you going to be okay today or?
Oh yeah, I'll be fine.
All right. Why is this day different from all other days is what Matt is saying. Let's jump right in on this. This is interesting. This is a slight moment. You know, I one of the things that I have been thinking about is there's been a lot of calls for media outlets to not cover Donald Trump's briefings. And particularly, you know, TV ones, so that it can't be a TV show, so they can't have the opportunity of having this sort of like free rally every day, because it's not as if the information he's giving has any value. It does not appear to be. And I'm still not 100% sure where I sit on that question. I think obviously the newspapers should be covering it, but I am inclined to believe that maybe there shouldn't be live coverage by news organizations that have any, you know, sense of integrity. They can break in and do, in my mind, like what we do, which is show the highlights. If there was any genuine information that came through in these instances, we would present it to you. But he just lies. He doesn't, it's just a series of lies and then ramblings. And then I think it's also of value to the American public to know that this lunatic is just ranting and raving when he's up there. And then there's all sorts of really horrible things that are happening. You know, we sort of like starting to piece together the story of, and we were talking about it quite a bit a week or two ago when it was clear that what the U.S. government was doing was sourcing stuff overseas, flying it into the country and then giving it to private distributors, not to distribute it because they have the resources in which to reach and the supply lines already existing, but basically to say, like, you can auction this stuff off. Because if it was exclusively for their ability to get these medical products to the places that need them in the country, then the U.S. government would say, here's the equipment that we have secured for you. You put this out there because you have the supply lines. You can make, I don't know, a 4% profit on it, a 5% profit on it, or, you know, show us what your normal profit is and we'll give you 3/4 of that. But instead what they did is like, here's the stuff, have at it. And they basically started an auction site. And some of it was sold overseas into other places in an extraordinary markups. And so what states started to do was they started to secure their own stuff. And having to secure their own stuff, and there's a story in the New England Medical Journal that outlines what officials in Massachusetts did to try and secure personal protection equipment. They literally had to drive in the middle of the night, like 7 states away, to get 18-wheelers that were labeled. The 18-wheelers were trucks that had signs on the side that said it was like produce. And as they were picking this stuff up, agents from the FBI came to intercept the delivery of these personal protection equipment. And they apparently let it go through after they were, like, you know, jostling with the people. Department of Homeland Security stood it. It sent people down there to stop it. They ended up getting part of it back to Massachusetts. But the other part is given to a private entity to then make more profit on it. This is insanity. This is, I mean, it's, I imagine there are a lot of countries in the world where this goes on that have gone on in the past, Latin America and Eastern Europe. There's been a lot of, you know, this type of just rampant corruption. I imagine this type of stuff went on in our invasion and occupation of Iraq. It is just sort of stunning that it is happening here in this country. I mean, we've always had some measure of corruption, of course, but this is another level, I think, in terms of the stakes that are involved here. And in terms of, we're talking about medical equipment, it's pretty amazing. But that was a brief detour into saying that there are moments that we're going to continue to play from the presidential briefings because, one, sometimes they're amusing. Other times, they cut to the quick as to what's going on. This one is amusing, one hopes. Here's Donald Trump. He's very, very mad at Maggie Haberman, who I think largely has been an access journalist from the New York Times in many respects. I don't know. Did she write her book already? I think she did. And so maybe, and who knows, maybe this is an indication of who one of her sources is. And now she's, you know, this is how she's sort of like maintaining some of her access now by reporting that Mark Meadows apparently has been having breakdowns, which I can understand. But I enjoy it because of him. Here is Donald Trump being asked that question about Mark Meadows.
Real information and responsible and thoughtful dialogue from their elected leaders and from the media. The media has been some very honest, but some very dishonest. You know that. You know that. I mean, I even read a story where Mark Meadows, tough guy, he was crying. He was crying. This was a Maggie Haberman. You know, she won a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of Russia, but she was wrong in Russia. So was everyone else. They should all give back their Pulitzer Prizes. In fact, it turned out that the crime was committed by the other side. The crime was not committed by this side. It was committed by the other side, a bunch of bad people. You saw the reports coming out over the last 2 weeks. They got caught. So Maggie Haberman gets a Pulitzer Prize. She's a third-rate reporter, New York Times. And we put her name up here last week. You saw that. People thought it was a commercial. It wasn't a commercial. It's like a commercial, but it wasn't a commercial. It was just clips. And because we exposed her as being a bad reporter, what happened is she came out and said, Mark Meadows was crying, and they made it sound. I said, Mark, and it's okay if he did. I wouldn't, you know, look. But I think he was crying probably really for the wrong reason they had it down. But he's not a crier. And if he was, I'd know cries. I could tell you people that you know that are very famous. They cry, and that's okay, too. But it was a nasty story in so many ways. It was fake news. And she only did it because we exposed her for being a terrible, dishonest reporter. She is. I've known her for a long while. I haven't spoken to her in a long time. I made the mistake. I take a picture with her at the desk a long time ago. Every time she does a story, if I say, I haven't spoken to her in long, many, many, many months, maybe years. I don't speak to her. She's fake. A lot of people are fake. A lot of people. We get a lot of fake people. But what happens is she writes a story as retribution, puts it in the New York Times. And the New York Times is a very dishonest newspaper.
Okay. I have a lot of thoughts about this, but one of which is this is why it's not really a briefing about coronavirus. Because he's spending his whole time trying to attack a reporter for reporting. And I can't tell if he like took this opportunity because he really wanted to knock Mark Meadows. You know, it'd be like the equivalent of like, I know there's a lot of stories out there about, you know, Matt huffing glue, and it's okay, but it's not true. Matt huffing glue.
They say Mark Meadows wears a diaper too, but you know, I haven't seen it. And even if he did, people wear diapers. Adults wear diapers.
It's true. It's true. I see bulkiness around his pants, but that doesn't mean anything. It could mean something.
Maggie
but it's
Haberman,
not true.
Maggie Haberman is trying to reinforce toxic masculinity on Mark Meadows by making fun of him when he cries. Let men cry.
Oh my God. Such insanity. Hey folks. Oh, this is good news. This is the one thing that has actually helped my sleeping a little bit. As you know, in life, you can make small changes that can lead to positive lifestyle changes throughout your life. The right towel turns a bathroom into a spa. Wearing certain loungewear turns a function into luxury. You can make all these upgrades with Brooklinen. You know Brooklinen is the internet's favorite sheets, but they're also home to bedding, loungewear, towels, and more with over 50,000 five-plus star reviews and counting. Now they have everything for life essentials, including shower curtains, bath mats, robes, totes, the final details that make your big upgrade. Folks, since the lockdown, I have purchased two new pillows. I have gone in, like I've decided that my stiff, unforgiving pillows, I need a little bit more comfort. Maybe I'm just getting old, but I got the plush non-allergenic or the hyperallergenic ones, of course. And I am loving it. First of all, I got the extended versions of the pillows. What do you call those? The kings. Because it's great for pillow fights with your kids because they can't see the second half of the pillow coming ever. But it's also incredibly comfortable. I love the new pillows. And I got a set of pillowcases, the cool, crisp kind that I like that they sell. They have multiple types of sheets. I have been so happy with Brooklinen. We've had them as sponsors for a couple of years. And I'm Brooklinenizing just about all of my bedding and whatnot. Brooklinen.com. It's the perfect place to start making small changes that make big differences. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, their comforters, their loungewear, their towels come with a lifetime warranty. Go on, make yourself comfortable. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping when you use promo code MAJORITY only at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. And also during the lockdown, not so easy to freshen up your wardrobe. I was very fortunate. I grabbed one of the shirts that I got from Stitch Fix, my thermal crew. And I've been living in that quite a bit. Don't wear it on the show because it doesn't have a collar, but very comfortable. It's my cash wear now. And in the world of clothes shopping, I think many people realize there's no consistent sizes. So why do you have to try and guess if a medium is really a guest or constantly have to return clothes that you purchase online to find something that fits perfectly? Well, Stitch Fix is a personal styling company that makes getting the clothes you love effortless. It's a completely different way to shop that's all about you every time. To get started, go to stitchfix.com/majority. You set up your profile. They deliver great looks personalized just for you in your colors, styles, and budget. You pay $20 styling fee for each fix, which is credited towards anything you keep. So you can schedule it anytime. There's no subscription required. You get shipping, returns, exchanges are easy and free. Stitch Fix does the hard work for you, making great styles effortless for everybody, including men, women, and kids. Folks, you know I have a little bit of blockage when it comes to dressing well, and Stitch Fix has been a huge help for me. I got they look like desert shoes, I guess a little bit, but they're a little bit nicer. They call them the leather chukka or chukka, I don't know. But it's great. A new pair of shoes. I got that Pills and Thermal crew. I got that Nashville 5-pocket straight fit pants, which is nice. I'm off of the carpenter style pants I used to wear all the time. sent back a mock neck sweater because I don't do mock necks. And I was debating about my flannel shirt they sent me, and it was appropriated by my daughter. So everybody won in that one. It's great. It was super easy. And I was super happy with the things that they picked out for me. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. It's everything in your box. You keep it 25% off. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Cheryl Laird about steadfast Dems, how social forces shape Black political behavior. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Cheryl Laird. She is an assistant professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College, and co-author of Steadfast Democrats, How Social Forces Shape Black Political Behavior, written with Duke professor Ismail White. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And now I got to tell you, I interviewed Davin Phoenix, who wrote The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. Maybe it was 5 or 6 weeks ago now. I have lost sort of semblance of time. Mm-hmm. And he referenced your book. And so I was fascinated by this. Now, of course, I think in the interim, or maybe it was just prior to this, we had our presidential primary on the Democratic side, more or less, decided by the votes, or it started a cascading, I guess, effect, by the votes of African Americans in South Carolina. And, this is, it's a fascinating topic. It's also a fascinating topic. I just finished watching an ad put out by the Trump, campaign, targeting African Americans. I want to dig into this, and really the nub of the book is this, what you call the process of racialized social constraint. But before we get there, let's talk about the just give me a broad assessment of Black voters, and I guess the fact that we have different, you know, just like we do with white voters, we have different sort of, I guess, subsets of voters within that rubric.
Yes, I think people often assume, because they see the Black voting of African Americans towards the Democratic Party, that there isn't diversity of political thought and political ideas and even perspectives within the community. And so one of the things we talk about very early on in the book is that we can see diversifying political views within the African American community, especially after the civil rights movement, and as economic opportunity has allowed for increased diversity amongst the group in terms of their economics. So there are more upper class Blacks, more middle class Blacks than they have been before over time. And with that, right, that means that motivations that we often think politically would shape how somebody engages in politics have changed for Blacks, yet we continue to see this behavior of the strong partisanship. And so we shouldn't minimize the diversity at all. In fact, the diversity helps to provide some perspective into why we can think about the social behavior we observe of Blacks, because we have Black conservatives and Black liberals. There are Blacks who are particularly positioned on certain economic policy. There are Blacks who are positioned on certain social policy. There are Blacks who are very highly religious. There are African Americans who are very far to the left and progressive. And all of them are engaging, though, in a collective political behavior that is, in, to some degree, right, having to consider how much is the group interest going to be prioritized over self-interest motivations and also the social aspect of it. And I can talk a bit more about that. But I mean, essentially, there's a lot of diversity within the Black political perspective and viewpoint.
Okay. And so the group interest is really where we start to get to that sort of racialized social constraint. But before we get there, how do we see this manifested? The range of you know, interests within the context of the African American community, because when it comes to the general election, what are we, like 89%, I think it is, of Black folk vote for the Democrat, which is, I think, you know, the next closest sort of voting block might be Jews, around 75% or something. So, you know, well in the distance. And but so where do we see that those differences manifested? In the primaries, or in terms of like engagement in politics?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, the primary season is probably one of the opportunities to see that, and especially this primary season. I think this one is a very unique circumstance because of how we have seen the various candidates that were coming in and who was in the lead early on, right? So we had Bernie Sanders, we had Mayor Buttigieg, and different people coming in, and people not really knowing where African Americans were going to fall. I think the political diversity then speaks to a lot of the ways in which people were shifting in their politics, right? At some points, people were considering that Joe Biden may not be as strong with the African American community. Maybe Bernie Sanders would do better. Maybe another candidate would do better. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the political diversity that you see there, right? That there are some African Americans who are, for instance, fairly progressive individuals who align very strongly with the viewpoints of Bernie Sanders and then the political views that he has, but may be risk averse, right? And if they're trying to consider who can win in the election against President Trump, they may be more likely then to lean in a way that would then go with a candidate that would be more likely in their mind to be somebody who could beat the beat President Trump. And in that case, that might be Joe Biden, right? There'd be other individuals who are actually aligned more politically with Joe Biden and see his politics as similar to their own. And so they are going to be individuals who would then support him without having any kind of discrepancy between their own viewpoint and the viewpoints that are being presented by his candidacy and his campaign. So the primary is often the place you see that. I think oftentimes you can also see where the political diversity comes about in even state or local level races, right? That's not necessarily the focus of our book, but it is another arena where you can see that candidate competition in local elections or state elections in races can often be very shaping to how people play out in the terms of their support for candidates, especially if there are multiple, for instance, African-American candidates running in a race. And you can also see it too in people's understandings of how do people meet the goal of trying to get racial justice, right? And sometimes that comes forth in dialogues and discussions, often in public domains, where people have conversations around, you know, what is needed to try to improve Black circumstances and various viewpoints politically and ideologically about, you know, anything from like a Tim Scott type of individual who is in the Republican Party, arguing much more for a more conservative, individualized type of approach to more collective politics. And so you can see it manifesting in different places, but especially in this electoral race, I think a lot of it was these considerations that were happening in the primary.
And I guess at the very least, let's move to, I guess one more thing too, that I think surprised me is the how many Black voters identify as conservative. And what does that mean in that context?
Yeah, so I think it is interesting, right? Because especially in political science, right, typically the literature shows us and the scholarship on it shows that when people are identifying as conservative on this measure, that is a fairly strong predictor of their partisanship, right? So that would should be kind of correlated very strongly with ideological leanings to conservative and their partisanship. For African Americans, it doesn't. And I think for African Americans, ideology is not as meaningful in the same capacity as the group identification and the group interest and the understanding of the political norms, which ties to partisanship. So in this case, ideological diversity can exist, but the partisan norm is what is the standout, right? Which is really what is serving as the way in which one is going to engage in politics. So I think they have an understanding of what conservative ideology means, but it doesn't necessarily go one-to-one with partisanship, because partisanship for the group is a completely different understanding than I think we traditionally see from other groups who participate.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm asking because I'm not even sure what constitutes conservative anymore. And it seems to me that, well, I mean, honestly, like, I mean, can you tell me what set of policies are associated with conservatism? And for me, if I was really pressed at this point, the only thing I would say would be a certain amount of, you know, like being anti-choice, maybe also having some measure of LGBTQ prejudice. And then and then really it's, you know, in this day and age, it's whatever Donald Trump says it is. I mean, you know, and a certain amount of like of white supremacy that may not be obviously articulated in that way. But that's why I'm sort of fascinated by what, if you have a sense as to what, when an African-American says that my ideology is conservative, I mean, what does that mean? They, you know, like, it, like,
yeah,
like I really don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting, right? In our book, we tried to actually assess it, keeping in mind that the measure that we typically use basically asks people to put themselves on an ideological scale of liberal to conservative. So it doesn't actually define it for them. So there, then, we had to think about, okay, well, what other ways can we tap into conservatives? Because I think you're right. There is an association now with conservatism that has gone to a much more polarized space than we had seen before. And African Americans, conservatism could be anything for that community to be, for instance, somebody who religiously is conservative, like religiosity, because African Americans as a racial group are some of the strongest, like basically participants within like the Christian faith, right? And so that could be identifying as conservatism, but it's not specifically explained in that question. So we looked at other measures. And so some of the things where we see some indicators of African Americans who are conservative has to do with government guaranteeing jobs and income, support for government health insurance plans, government action to help the poor, government reducing income, the differences between the rich and the poor, and seeing more conservative leaning on that, looking at how the government should do, what government should do to try to improve standards for African Americans. We're seeing more conservative leaning on that question, saying that the government shouldn't intervene. So a lot of the questions that we tried to tap into were related to government, central government intervention into issues of equity going on, and do we see more African Americans leaning in favor of that or against that, and how has that shifted over time? And so that's what we have seen and observed in the data. But I agree with you, the conservative moniker and the label itself is fraught, completely fraught, and very polarized with the environment. And I think African Americans would potentially identify as conservative, but really because partisanship and the social engagement around partisanship serves to be one of the largest things in terms of how they engage politically, is really where they are going to be the most likely to make sure that they are in alignment with where the group is expecting them to be.
All right. Well, so let's talk about that, that sort of notion of, of the group and of these social constraints. There, you have some, really, you've recounted some really fascinating, like sort of studies that manifest this. But explain to us the thesis. Well, and you've sort of hinted at it on some level that there is that these varying different, factors are outweighed ultimately in certain circumstances when it comes to Black voters making a choice.
Absolutely, right. And I think kind of like the key takeaway from our book is that Black partisanship is maintained through Black social networks. And so when we are looking at Democratic partisanship over the last several decades, we need to understand that although you have these things that have changed the diversity and the political diversity of the community and even economically, that over time we continue to see this Democratic Party norm, especially when it comes to like presidential elections. And that we see that start to get formulated in this way, or at least kind of manifesting in this way when it comes to Democratic partisanship in the civil rights movement, right, and the consolidation at that time. And a lot of that has to do with the civil rights legislation that is passed at that time, and also the avenue for even being able to participate in politics electorally and even in representation happening for African Americans through the Democratic Party. And through that, a norm, we argue in the book, is established and norm is maintained and reinforced for the community that basically is the understanding that to be Black is to be Democrat. And supporting this norm of Black partisanship is important for the group, and it is expected by individuals that they do that as members of the group, right? And it's understood that that is what one should do, that this is the best way for the group to achieve the goals of political advancement and opportunity and equity is if we do this, right? And that this norm goes back historically, that we can see norms of collective action and behavior going on for African Americans all the way back to slavery, right? When it comes to abolitionist movements, efforts to try to escape plantations, which we talk about in the book, as well as during the periods after slavery, when Black African Americans were part of the Republican Party en masse, that all of those attempts and efforts are done as a collective means to try to make sure that African Americans have voice in the system. And it's a majority-based system. So when you're a minority group, this is going to be the effective way of doing that. And we argue that the ability for this norm to maintain itself over time has a lot to do with racial segregation, right? That African Americans are in communities that are predominantly, if not all Black, are dealing with day-to-day interactions that are predominantly, if not all Black. And the norm of political participation is clearly understood, right? And so that then leads to an in-mass behavior that we've observed where African Americans participate in politics this way because there's an understanding that this is just what we do. This is how we do this. And so in the book, we try to examine this by looking at ways that we can measure the social constraint behavior. Essentially, can we show instances in which an individual is being asked by an African American, or they are dealing with the interaction with another African American versus somebody who's non-Black, or even in the absence of anybody, and show that there is some sort of pressure that people understand that leads to this partisan behavior? And we argue that this type of socialized behavior is important to understand because this then gets at the diversity component of political and economics within the Black community, that African Americans who have motivations that potentially could lead them to voting for the Republican Party, right, like self-interest motivations economically, they may be very well off. Politically, they may be people who lean conservative, like the way you define conservative often is viewed. And yet we don't see that happening in large numbers. And we argue that constraint, that they feel restrained in doing that. And those who feel more comfortable potentially going against the norm that's understood are individuals who aren't going to be dealing with that social aspect as much. In fact, those people are probably in fairly racially diverse social networks that allow for those ideological views potentially to manifest into their partisan behavior. So that's kind of a summing up of the book there. But I mean, essentially, this is what we're thinking about, that is a social process. And if you want a group to participate in a collective behavior in a majority system as a minority group, that one way to do that is to basically behave in this way. And in order for people to do it and know that that's something to be done, that there also needs to be some repercussions for people who decide not to. And that's where we talk about this idea of social sanctions, essentially people getting reprimanded by the group openly for deciding to basically go away from the understood norm, which is voting for the Democratic Party and doing something else. And we've seen that happen. Kanye West was like one of the most popular examples, right. Steve Harvey. But in all of our studies, we're trying to really examine that.
Okay. So, and I want to walk sort of back through that. And certainly I want to talk about one or two of the big studies. So they're sort of fascinating manifestations of this, but to be clear, the social constraint, I mean, you're talking about sort of like how it operates, how it's enforced. I just want to talk for a moment about the impetus. The impetus is that there are a fundamental set of transcending issues that impact everyone who, I mean, this is the impetus for the constraint. There is a fundamental set of transcendent issues that impact Black people, regardless of their religiosity, regardless of their how much money they make, for the most part. I mean, across the board, right? That's the argument. Is that even part of it? I mean, how much of that is just simply a function of, look, the bottom line is, we're going to do better on some very fundamental basic rights issues with Democrats than we will with the Republicans. Is that basically what that sort of first building block of that social constraint is?
I think so. It has both of those components to it, right? So I think one of the building blocks for sure has to do with what issues are directly affecting African Americans, right? And the long history of race being so defining to the Black lived experience, and that has been foundational, right, to how America has been designed, to our politics, to our institutions, and to your day-to-day interactions and lived circumstances, right? So foundationally, right, as a group, it has become understood that individually trying to achieve uplift becomes an issue, right? That it is not enough because race becomes so defining. So collectively, it is understood then that in order for individuals to basically make moves ahead, right? The group itself also has to be able to do so, right? That individually, you're always going to fall back into the race issue, right? And that's regardless of kind of how much you've succeeded or even moved up or had economic success or had particular things happen for you. And so that is going to be very shaping to that. I think the understanding then of the two parties is that over time, especially in this contemporary period, that the Democratic Party has become seen and viewed as the party that would allow for more advancement for the group, not only from the legislation and the policy that has been passed when those individuals have been in power, but additionally, that most of the Black elected officials that we even see now in office and have come to power for the Democratic Party, right? So the opportunities for the realization of Black political involvement, not only through the voting aspect, but actually elected office and officials, has occurred through the Democratic Party. So they are viewed as the one that is going to be the most likely to speak to these group interests relative to the Republican Party, right? So it is very pro-partisan behavior. I think sometimes we get asked, is it anti-Republican? Like Republicans have done racist things in the history Southern strategy, certain time periods after the radical Republican period, after slavery. But it's a pro-social, it's a pro-partisan behavior, right? It is an idea that this particular party is going to be the one that best embodies what is needed for the group to be able to achieve some of the equity and equality that it wants.
Okay, I want to put a pin in that specific thing because that has implications as to whether people are, you know, how people are going to come out. I mean, because when we talk about the primary, right, it was not a pro. We've described that vote, at least in part, as a negative partisanship vote in some way, right? That the driving force of supporting Joe Biden was obviously in part like, okay, I'm simpatico with him politically. But the other driving force was, this is the guy who's going to beat Donald Trump. I mean, it was a vote for Joe Biden more often than not. I mean, this is true of all Democrats, across the board, was a vote against Donald Trump in some way, or, you know, was driven by that. So how do you,
it has some drive.
I mean, how do you,
it is driven some part by that. Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll swing back around because I also want to ask about, I mean, ultimately get to, you know, the Obama to no one voters and those type of folks, in 2016. But before we get there, so tell us, I don't know. I mean, there was a study, I'm trying to think of the, I don't know if I have it right in front of me here, but the, there was a couple of studies that really stuck out for me. Would you go through one or two of those that sort of like manifest this? I think you did one experiment where you had people in a room and you had different there was also where you had a white person and a black person come in and say where they were going to contribute money.
Yes, I can talk about it for sure. So in the experiment, we were trying to, again, basically get some sort of measure of racialized social pressure, right? So from a social science perspective, what we want to do is capture that empirically in some way. And so what we were trying to do here is then design a study that we could test pressure. How does pressure look? And how do we make sure that it's a racialized pressure? So we set up a circumstance in the 2012 election where we had people being told about this opportunity for them to donate to campaigns. And in fact, we were going to be providing them with the money to donate to these campaign these organizations that were supportive of particular campaigns for the candidate, right? So no money was actually donated to any campaign. It's all for the purpose of the experiment, and everybody was debriefed after it was done. But essentially, what we have people do is that we tell them we're part of this organization, we're working with the university, and we are asking about people having this. We're basically providing this opportunity for people to do these donations. And so here you get $10, and there'll be two boxes in a room that you're going to go into. And for every dollar that you put into the box, will be $10 donated to this organization that supports this campaign. Right. And so in doing that, we basically set up three groups. So in one group, an individual went in who's African American by themselves to do the donation. And then in the second group, we paired that individual with a white person. And we told that white person who was working with us as part of the study that when they walk in the room, they should say, I'm giving all of my money to the Obama organization. Right. And then put all of their money into the box. And then a third group was created, and that was with an African-American person being partnered with the person who was the participant in the study. And that person was also working with us, and we told them to do the exact same thing. Now, we argue that statement, I'm giving all my money to Obama, right, is the one part of the pressure being placed on an individual, because now the norm is being stated in the room. And additionally, that the race of the individual is going to influence the amount of money that then gets donated to either the Romney or the Obama campaign. And what we see happen is basically we see one, that there isn't that much actual donation to Mitt Romney at all by any individual. I think we had two individuals in the whole study who actually donated a couple dollars to Mitt Romney. But we see a larger number of donating to Obama, but that number being varying based off of the presence of a white individual or the presence of a black individual. Essentially, when a black person is there, people are more likely to give more of their money to the Obama organization than if they're in the presence of a white person making that statement about the norm, or if they're by themselves, where they don't have to worry necessarily about the pressure of the norm. And so in this case, this is manifesting through a donation process as opposed to like, for instance, a vote. But still here, like, we argue that is just one example where we can show, right, that there is some pressure. It's a very conservative test. One wouldn't expect it to have that much of an effect. But we do get to control for race and know that even a white individual cannot place that type of social pressure on an individual that we see, for instance, from African Americans when it comes to the partisan norm for the group.
What, which had more, so, and just to be clear, the subjects of the mm-hmm. test were African Americans. So which had more, or no, was it also, were there also white folk there too?
there wasn't any white participants. Okay. So we did it strictly with African-American participants. And then the only racial variation was from the person who was working with us in the situation of the Confederate. Yep.
So what was the ranking? Like when a black person came in and said, I'm giving all my money to Barack Obama, that got the most amount of donations from the test subjects. When the white person came in and said it, did that outweigh when nobody said it, or was it vice versa?
So they were about equal statistically, and particularly, but it was definitely statistically distinctive when it was an African-American individual, because there's a self-interest component as well, which is, and I should have said this a little bit earlier, because the person could donate the money or they could decide to pocket it, right? So they were also in a situation where they could say that I'm going to give this portion to Obama and then put some back into their pocket. So we were seeing how much did they decide to take and how much did they decide to give in the donation. And again, here with the white individual, not as much relative to the condition where you have African-Americans by themselves, African-Americans with another black person in the room with them.
And what did, did you get a sense of what was driving people? Was it just simply shame? Was it just a sense of like, hey, wait a second, this is a good idea? I mean, do we have a sense of like what the emotional response is made up of, or is it varied?
So this is probably where we could have partnered with Davin at that time for the emotional response, but we did get to look at, for instance, motivations when it comes to people's belief about money, right? So how do people think about doing money over anything else? And we found that people who are most likely to defect away from the norm, right? Defect away from this understood party norm. And in this case, we argue that Barack Obama is like the biggest manifestation of the party norm being achieved, which is a black individual within the White House. That those individuals who are more likely to defect from that are individuals who have a high premium placed on money in their mind, money over anything, money over their social relationships, money over their friendships. So we asked a couple questions about that. We also assessed how much people understood the role of social sanctions, right? So essentially, how do people understand the behavior that might happen to an individual who defects from the norm? And that was playing in people's mind, but essentially people who believe that these social sanctions were right or wrong didn't make a difference. It was more so the awareness of the fact that these sanctions exist. And if they are aware of that, right, that would then also influence the donation and the likelihood of defection as well. But particularly the value on money. The other thing that I think was interesting is that there's a concept in the field that we have known as a linked fate. And it essentially, it means that what you, I believe what happens to the group has an influence on my individual life. And people have argued that this is one of the biggest predictors of black partisan behavior. But we argue that it actually isn't necessarily enough to provide us that insight into partisan norms, because how do you maintain this over time just off of that belief? And in that measure as well, linked fate didn't really make a difference in donations. So even where you fell in terms of how strongly you feel like the group has an influence on my individual life did not necessarily affect the donation, right? It really did have a lot to do with the social aspect as well as where people valued money over their social relationships. So that was kind of one of the assessments we were able to get. We didn't do a measure of emotional assessments, but I do think that there is an understanding of the social interaction that is really key to understanding the donation.
Okay. So one is like, if I'm really money centric, I'm not going to vote for the Democrat. I mean, that seems to be fairly consistent across the race and across, I would imagine that has been at least a big chunk of the Republican in the history of the Republican Party, at least the modern history. You know, there's been some that's not a terribly shocking impetus. The other is more of like a negative constraint, I guess, which is this social sanctions. Like what does that mean? Like my mom is going to get pissed at me or I mean, what does that look like?
So for African, for the Black community, I mean, your mom being pissed at you could be one thing, because she could be an enforcer of of the norm. But for instance, there are terms and language that is used to refer to somebody who seems to be going against the group interest. People might call them an Uncle Tom or a sellout, and that will be seen as somebody who's betrayed the group in some way. And in particular, when it comes to the party norm, I think that's often where we see that language thrown out. So when people refer to, for instance, people like Clarence Thomas, Ben Carson, even Tim Scott, Mia Love, often that language is talked about in this way, to the point where a number of Black Republicans have openly spoken about the idea that they find themselves often pushed aside by African Americans because they've decided to be part of the Republican Party. And again, those social relationships and the social sanctions are effective because of the ways in which race is very defining to the social network of African Americans. If you weren't worried about what other African Americans are thinking of you, because those relationships aren't very defining to your day-to-day, your economic gains, your lived experience, because your relationships are more diverse, then those won't necessarily be things that are stressful or a problem for you or something that you would worry about. But for most African Americans, they are dealing with social networks that are heavily defined by race. So that's what allows those sanctions to work. On their own, they wouldn't necessarily be effective unless you are legitimately worried about those social interactions. And it's the racial segregation that allows for that to be maintained over time, right? Because Blacks still remain in communities that are heavily segregated. I mean, we're seeing a lot of that even come to light within the COVID-19 crisis, right? That those historical factors still shape Black life. And it would play a role here when it comes to those sanctions. So your mom could be one of the people who calls you a sellout. I mean, family and friends, people, we asked about that, friends and social networks in the book. We asked people, you know, if you had friends or family members who knew for instance, that you potentially did not vote for Barack Obama, right? What would they think of you, or how would they view you? And most African Americans noting that they would have an issue, right? That those people would be very strongly upset with them or bothered by the fact that they decided to do that. And that would be concerning to them, that would be something that they are worried about.
But it could also be a clergy. It could be a celebrity. It could be friends down the street type of thing. I mean, it could come from anywhere. Is that the idea?
It could come from anywhere. I mean, I think in the case that we are using, for instance, in the study that we did where we saw that effect, African Americans the Black people that were in that study didn't know each other.
Right.
Like, we deliberately pulled students that were separate from the individuals that were participating so that they had no relationship. But, you know, one of the things I've talked about within African American communities, and I think a lot of communities of color are fictive kinship, right? Or these ties together with people, even though they are not biologically related to you, that those relationships and connections to other Blacks are still there, even if you don't know them personally. People even talk about, you know, passing another Black person in an area, especially that's predominantly white or not largely African American, and passing one another and giving each other a head nod, like just an acknowledgement of seeing somebody else. You don't have to know that person,
right, but
you do know that that person is Black. So that plays a big part of it too. So it doesn't have to be someone you directly know to enforce that.
And it doesn't even necessarily have to be anybody actively enforcing it. I mean, it sounds like, I'm in a room full of people I don't know, it is the fact that I look around and I see that they are also Black, and I am projecting on them their expectation of me and the group.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's exactly right. And that's exactly how we discuss it in the theory.
So what do we make of, I mean, this is fascinating, because so what would that say about voters, you know, Black non-voters, or Black Obama to no one voters in 2016? I mean, what was there not enough? I mean, where do those folks fit in terms of, did they perceive the situation as like they're in that room, you know, just to use that experiment as a template. Were they in that room and nobody came in to say, I'm giving all my money to Barack Obama? Or were they in a room where a white guy came in and said, I'm giving my money to Barack Obama? I mean, what explains these people in this instance not feeling that pressure?
And these individuals are, can you say those again? I'm sorry.
There's a significant part of the African-American community, places like, let's say, Milwaukee and in Detroit, and I'm speaking specifically in the context of the 2016 election, who had voted for Obama and didn't vote this time, or voted for nobody specifically for president. Is there a way to sort of glean and say like, oh, well, this is indicative of the fact that maybe there was not enough attention paid to sort of trigger that sense of you have an obligation to go vote?
Yeah. So, you know, the primary contest is an interesting one. And I will say our book focuses heavily on the general election. So potentially what you could have is a motivation problem, right? So not that people didn't understand the norm, but they may not have felt motivated to participate in the electoral process. And in a primary contest, right, there's a typically strong partisan. So a large majority that we saw of in major states where Joe Biden was able to gain the leverage that I think led him into his presumptive nominee position right now, were where we saw high levels of Black participation within the primaries. But I agree with you that there are some African Americans who do.
Well, I'm talking about
abstention, right?
I'm specifically talking about the Clinton election, the Clinton Trump election.
Oh, in the Clinton-Trump election. Okay, yes. So that's, again, I think a motivation situation there, right? Like not an understanding necessarily of the norm, but a turnout. Now, I will say, though, in the Trump-Clinton election, one of the things to think about there is the comparison, right? So Obama is the full-on kind of realization of what this norm is supposed to do, right? Like if the goal is to have say and influence in politics, then one's involvement in this norm, right, is the goal is not only to have policy and decisions being made that are going to be important for African Americans, but it's also gaining power in the office, right? So Obama is like the massive realization of that by having him become the president of the United States. I would never compare the numbers, and I don't think Ishmael would either, of the turnout that we observe of African Americans in 2016 to any of the Obama years. Like that would be weird because he's an exception in terms of what he embodies, right? He's the first Black president. Now, if you compare those numbers to 2004, before he runs, African American turnout is basically the same. Like they're statistically indistinguishable. So I think that that's one thing to keep in mind is the uniqueness of the electoral contest with Obama. I don't think Clinton was going to be able to ride in on a wave of that same level of Obama turnout because of what Obama represented. However, I also agree to the point that you're pointing out here, which is that there was potentially a motivation issue amongst some African Americans. From reports that I heard from field workers, from different campaigns, as well as people even on the ground in certain communities like Milwaukee, like you mentioned, being one example, arguing that the Clinton campaign didn't do as much investment into on-the-ground grassroots work. And I think that that's a big part of the considerations around the social network aspect of political participation for Blacks when it comes to their Democratic partisanship, because you really do need to energize the networks. You need to energize the communities. You need to energize the social community that is there. And if that wasn't being done in key states, because an assumption was made that support would just be there at the level that we had seen from Obama, you would be mistaken, right? And you would really need to do that work. And from what I heard, at least read, even in the New York Times and other places, was that some people were reporting that they did not see that level of campaign investment coming from the Clintons. There was some discussions of issues related to African Americans, but again, on the ground, not as much effort there potentially. And so if you're going to deal with a mobilization problem, that's when you would see that, right? You wouldn't necessarily see as much turnout But again, I don't think the numbers were that much lower. In fact, I think they're statistically the same between 2016 and 2004.
I see. And just to be clear, it's not a question in this instance. From your perspective, that it's about talking about the issues at that point, right? I mean, because presumably, if you go back to that experiment, Barack Obama is still the same Barack Obama, regardless of who is advocating giving him money. And it's the peer pressure on some level, the social constraints, as you call it, that are the ones that get people to go and actually drop the cash in the bucket.
Yeah, no, that is correct, right? And so if you wanted to, and you know, that's why we begin our book, I think, really thinking about, for instance, an example like Alabama with the Roy Moore and Doug Jones race there, right? Because it was a surprise when people woke up the morning after that race had gone on and found out that Roy Moore had lost, but Doug Jones did not win, and people were trying to figure out how that happened. Well, there was a huge grassroots organizing that was going on the ground there, led heavily by African-American women in the state of Alabama, trying to ensure that people turned out to vote. So voting and the participation and the exercising of the norm becomes a social process. And if that is not a focus, right, it doesn't necessarily it doesn't mean that your policies alone or your positions alone are going to do enough to motivate people out there. Like, you're going to have to get on the ground. You're going to have to get those networks in place, because African Americans are also dealing with extensive challenges when it comes to the franchise, right? Like, the participation we even observe of Blacks is extraordinary in the face of numerous things that get put into place to try to hinder Black participation in the electoral process, right? We just watched that in Wisconsin. Like, we just saw that happen, right? So you really have to think hard about what you're going to do to motivate individuals. And if people aren't being as motivated by potentially the campaign, even if they agree with the policies, what are you doing on the ground to get people to turn out?
And that efforts have to be, I mean, according to your work, it sounds like need to be, at the very least, that person-to-person contact. That contact has to come from African Americans. I mean, it can't be.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, fair enough.
Yes. Yes. No, it would need to be person-to-person contact.
It's fascinating work. Cheryl Lard, Steadfast Democrats, How Social Forces Shape Black Political Behavior. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks again, Cheryl. All
right. Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half in a moment. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. By becoming a member, you not only get extra content every day, almost every single day. I mean, we can't do it every single day, but I don't know, half a dozen days out of the year that we don't, if that many. But you're also supporting the show in a time where obviously ad rates are down across the board. I encourage you to, obviously, if you're in a position to support this show, support this program, but support all the shows and the media outlets that you like. I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to do is to sort of expand. I mean, we pay for a lot of the content that, you know, that we use on this show, at least subscribe to a lot of these magazines, but I'm sort of expanding the universe in which I pay for that content. If I read the thing once every 2 months now, I am going and subscribing just because of, you know, across the board, it's not quite as easy for me to go and, you know, support a local restaurant, but this is one thing that you can do and to help sort of maintain an infrastructure of media in this country. It's important. We're seeing layoffs in like LA, I mean, everywhere, really. And so, you know, if you have the means, of course, and if you don't, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And if you've ever sent one in the past, and for whatever reason, you know, I don't know what our leakage is, but probably I miss 5 to 10% of the requests at any given time. Send, just keep doing it. Understand it's not, it is not you. It is me. And sometimes we just, I just miss them. We just get a ton of emails and I just miss them. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm going to do that one. And I, you know, someone starts yelling in my house. And so I go and deal with it. So if you are someone who can't afford a membership, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. If you're someone who can, by all means, great time now to become a member. And we are now accepting through our system via Kyle PayPal as well. So you can go sign up at jointhemajorityreport.com, and there's a myriad of different ways in which you can pay. Not Bitcoin still, but I don't know if anybody trades in that anymore. Also, like I say, support other shows. TMBS will be live again tomorrow night. You can support that over at patreon.com/TMBS or watch it at youtube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. The Nomaki Const Show, Nomaki will be with us tomorrow, but you can find that at patreon.com, The Nomaki Show, or at Nomaki Const on YouTube. And the Antifada, Jamie's going to join us in the fun half. Check that out, patreon.com/TheAntifada. Matt, what's happening on the literary hangover side? You guys are talking Bacon's Rebellion while also performing your own rebellion on your Twitch channel. Is that right?
Oh, I don't know about quite that. Well, what we did do is one of the most informationally nutritious Twitch streams people have ever seen. I played A Plague's Tale: Innocence while playing selections in a word-to-text program from Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish on The Plague Town and on Daniel Defoe's A Journal from the Plague Year. So check that out. It's very multimedia. People's minds were blown. A few random people happened across the stream. They didn't know what they didn't know what they were getting into, but they enjoyed it. So yes, please subscribe to me at twitch.tv/literary hangover.
I can't help like but just think that there's like some like PhD candidate, you know, in, I don't know, University of Kansas, who's just like taking a break and then it's just like, what? People just sort of like freaking out talking about like this weirdo who's playing this stuff while he's playing this. Yeah, what game are you playing? Aren't you supposed to say that?
A Plague's Tale: Innocence. I said that up front. Very interesting game.
I didn't know if that was the book or the actual game.
No, yeah. No, that's the game. And it's, you sort of go through a medieval town and it's during the plague. Very interesting. There's the white.
Very apropos.
Yes, it's all very relevant, folks. All very relevant.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. We will take calls starting now. We will also take your IMs on the app at majorityapp.com. You can sign up. You don't have to sign up for anything. You just get the app. It's free. Majorityapp.com.
Also, what? Speaking of Twitch, Jamie's at the Antifada has a Twitch today, so she'll probably tell us about that later.
Okay, good. Well, Jamie will hop on the stream and... see you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me.
1-2-3-4-5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2-38-56-27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy!
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.